You're with Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth.
Good morning. Nice to have your company on Focus today. One afternoon, my daughter told me how she managed to read a note which had been passed between two friends, suggesting they don't play with her at lunchtime. My daughter was horrified and incredibly upset, and her tears broke my heart. But she decided to approach the author of the note and tell her how hurt she was. So she did that the next morning. There was an immediate apology and they moved on. Nobody else got involved and there doesn't seem to have been a problem since. Now, luckily, she had the guts to deal with it, but I suspect it's not always that easy. As your children get older and their friends have more influence, how do you protect them when things go wrong? How do you deal with a broken friendship and the broken heart that comes with it? When do you step in and what do you do? Today on Focus, when friends turn into frenemies, the complicated world of childhood friendships.
Focus Perth with Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth.
On the panel today is Linda Stade. She is an educator and she writes a lot about this topic. And also we have Jane Carmignani. She's a psychologist, and both of our panel members work at Santa Maria College. And I will get to the panel in a moment. First, though, I want you to have a listen to some primary school students who told Focus producer Joe Trilling and me what makes a good friend and what doesn't.
I think friends needs to be honest and they need to stand up to you, stand up for you, and when people are being mean. And I also reckon they should be like, they cheer you up when you're sad and they don't run away from you. Yeah, it's not very nice if your friends are running away from you or they don't feel like you're included.
A person that's honest, that's like kind, and they listen to you, and someone fun.
And have you ever had a friend be mean to you? How did that feel?
Well, when they be mean, you don't normally feel good and they normally go away, but later on we always sort things out.
How do you sort things out?
Well, we say we didn't agree on something. In the end, we both decided that, like, we were like, we could be both right. And sometimes my other friends help me sort it out.
Good friends always play together. They be kind, and good friends never let down other friends.
Definitely honesty, and I reckon they respect your ideas and they're always there for you when you need it the most. They don't let anyone push you around, so.
Are most of your friends friends you've had for a long time, or do you kind of change friends?
Well, I've met quite a few friends each year, but I've had one very good friend who's been in my classes for a long time.
And have you ever had a disagreement with a friend or had a friend be mean to you?
Yeah, I just didn't feel very good. It didn't feel great. Yeah, I didn't like the feeling I was getting.
How were they mean to you?
Well, sometimes they make too big of a deal out of a fight, or sometimes we have a little bit of a disagreement, or, you know. But we always manage to make up in the end when we just say, well, it doesn't really matter, and we can just get over it.
I think what makes a good friend is them being kind and nice to you and not bossing you around. Yes, and not using you as their private servants and stuff like that, tricking you into being their friend.
And when you meet girls and you are deciding who you are going to hang around with at school, do you look for those sort of things in somebody? Do you spend a bit of time thinking about what kind of person that is and how good that person would be for you?
Yeah, I kind of observe, like, a lot of people and kind of go from group to group until I find a specific group that I like.
Girls ever been mean to you?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, it's not consistent, but a few times people have said a few things, but I just try to ignore it and forget that it's ever happened and try to focus on, like, my real friends who actually like me, so, yeah.
Does it hurt?
Yeah, it hurts quite a bit.
And how do you deal with it?
I just pretend that I don't actually care about it so they won't do anything else.
And what do you see in the playground?
Well, there's, like, gossip a lot with, like, girls and stuff, because girls like to chat and everything. But there can be a little bit of rough stuff, but I don't get into that.
And in the scheme of things, the things that people sometimes argue over, are they things that actually matter?
Usually not really. Like, they're usually just little misunderstandings, usually about what people have said.
Do you think you see more of that as you get older?
Yeah, because when you're young, you don't really mean the things you say, but when you get older, you mean a lot of the things you say. Like, sometimes it can come out accidentally, but usually you know what you're saying 90% of the time.
Have you heard the term frenemies?
Yeah.
What do you think that means?
People who are supposed to be your friends, but in a way they're enemies.
Such honest insights. Kids are so honest. And thank you to those students who shared a few of their thoughts with us. Let's get to our panel. When we talk about this world of frenemies, what age are we talking about that you see conflicts in friendship start to emerge?
Very young. About 5 or 6, you start seeing it. I think it then progressively gets worse. Bullying is, research shows that it peaks at about 9 or 10. And we all talk about middle school girls being particularly prone to this behaviour because they're sort of establishing their social place in the world at that age. So it does start young and happens for a long time. And for a lot of us, it still happens as adults. I think it's a myth that, you know, we come out the other end at 17 and we're all lovely and kind to each other. Friendships have problems and there's one-upmanship, and people, when they feel afraid or threatened in a friendship, they will strike out at others.
Is it more common among girls?
I think so, yes.
And why is that? Is it because girls, what I observe is they play social games where the rules can change and there's a lot of chatter, tea parties, whereas boys are playing games with rules, football, cricket. That's what I see in my children, and those rules have very definite boundaries. The girls change the rules as they go.
Yeah, girls are very verbal, and so they tend to build relationships verbally. Instead of with boys, they tend to, it's, you know, playing sport or being competitive or doing activities together. Girls will often sit and talk. So that's a reason why it happens more, I think, with girls. And that gossiping that the young lady talked about being really dominant is really real for girls because they bond using gossip sometimes. And there is positive gossip, and then there's the negative gossip where you're actually running down someone else's character.
Jane, what about boys then? Do they have some similar issues when it comes to sort of frenemies?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because, as Linda said, you see this sort of different behaviour in girls and boys and how they connect with one another. And a lot of the research shows that even from a young age, girls interact face-to-face and their friendships are based a lot on sort of disclosure and secrets and, as Linda said, being verbal and talking. And boys tend to interact side-by-side. It's about physicalness and it's about, you know, interests and sports and those sorts of things. So when you look at the problems that surround girl and boy friendships, they're quite different. And there's girls will use those sorts of relationship techniques to, you know, have that one-upmanship in their friendships, whereas boys might use more their competitive side of things. But what's interesting about boys is we're finding more and more that they crave connection as well in different ways, and some of our societal norms have made it difficult for them to actually go out and really have value around close connections with other boys.
So they want some best friends too, just like
they
girls.
They absolutely do. And we're finding that more and more, and we're a lot more in tune to that. I think they still do have different sort of brain wiring to girls. We know from some of the research that when we look at friendships and we ask girls to think about friends and we ask boys to think about friends, the different areas of the brain that's particularly around reward, social reward and motivation, they light up with girls, but with boys they don't light up as much. Boys light up more around competitiveness and performance, but we do know that they also crave good mates.
And what about the kids then that come and see you? What is the main issue that they're dealing with? Is it fractures in friendships?
Yeah, absolutely. I think most of the things that we deal with would be friendship issues within a friendship group. So we will talk to girls that are having problems with the girls within their group, and it probably the most common thing would be exclusion.
So that's the big phrase out, or we don't want to play with you today.
Yeah.
For no apparent reason other than we just don't want to, and we can exercise our right to do that.
And sometimes that is all it is. It's just this sort of, you know, we talk about this, the importance that friendship takes on, particularly as we go into middle school. You know, we're moving a little bit away from our parents. We're moving closer to our peers. It's about finding our social identity, finding our independence. So we are really looking for those connections with peers. So it's this, unfortunately, it can be quite an effective weapon to exclude someone. Because, you know, anything that undermines their social identity and, you know, their social status is actually quite significant for them. Like, we know that social rejection actually lights up the same area of the brain as physical pain. Like, so, it quite literally hurts.
And so some of the examples you gave, the exclusion, for instance, what are some other examples of things that, relational aggression. What does that look like? You, one example there, exclusion. What else constitutes that?
Silent treatment. So when they freeze out a child and just won't respond to them, which I think is really painful for a child because they can't even put their case forward as to why they shouldn't be excluded or given the silent treatment. And eventually they get very frustrated and they'll start ranting and yelling and why won't you listen to me and those sorts of things. And then there's something to laugh at for the other kids. So I think that's a really powerful one. And belittling, there's a lot of mean comments that are followed by, oh, I'm just joking.
JK,
just joking. And then they, or a compliment with an underhanded piece on the end. Like a girl was telling me yesterday that one of her friends said to her, you look really pretty for someone who's a bit chunky. Wow. Yes. So. Wow.
What impact does a comment like that have?
It shames you and it stuns you. It feels like you've been slapped. And as you said at the very beginning about your daughter and how she went home and she felt bad about it and she thought about it, we've all done that. We go home and we think, oh, I should have said this and I should have said that. I think your daughter showed incredible courage by going back the next day and making that child accountable for it. That's a really difficult thing for a child to do.
And I think she also just wanted to deal with it and move on straight away. Yes. She's not one, she doesn't like things to fester. Yes. So that's lucky that that's her character, but not everyone's like that. And it's interesting when you said then, JK, just kidding. It's common, is it?
Oh, very, yes.
Yeah. And we would always, when we work with the girls, we are encouraging them to problem solve it, try resolve the conflicts as your daughter, you know, decided on her own. And some girls do that really well and other girls don't. So we know there are certain skills that help with that, you know, that help to really, you know, not take things as sensitively or as much to heart when those sorts of comments are made. And some girls can brush that off more easily and other girls have more difficulty with it.
What motivates this behaviour?
Fear. It's fear of not belonging, fear of not being good enough, fear of not being included. I think it that drives the idea of if I can knock you off balance, that makes me feel balanced and accepted. Because if you're not out, then you're in. So if you can make somebody else out, then you're in. So I think fear is a big motivator.
I think also, yeah, I absolutely agree, that would be one of the number one things that motivates that. I also think that they are just trying to work out where they fit.
Mm.
It's a really tricky time. Like they're leaving that sort of more close, secure connection with parents. I mean, they're not leaving it behind, but they're actually trying to become a bit more independent from it. So they're going out and, you know, even with looking at high schools, that, you know, sometimes tripling the amount of students that they're up with compared to primary school, and they're trying to find where they fit. So sometimes to do that, they might actually sacrifice some of their normal values or some of their normal interests and beliefs, because when you're with a group that has a bit of social status or that has, you know, that brings you that sense of belonging and acceptance that you want, sometimes you're letting go of some of those values that you know are right. Like listening to those young people at the beginning, I love that. Like they said things that are so true and we know they know it, but it doesn't always transfer into that sort of friendship group on the campus, on the playground.
So being in the popular group then amplifies all of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Linda and I talk often about the popular group.
let's talk about the popular group.
Oh, it's fascinating because the popular group is interesting and there's a lot of research out there that talks about the popular group and the likeable group. So there's sometimes an assumption that the popular group is well-liked. It's not always the case. So what we know now is we have sort of pro-social popularity, But we also have antisocial popularity, and they maintain their popularity by using not always that popular power in a positive way. But that's okay because they get that status and that's how they maintain that popularity. And we always say, who told them they were popular? Like, they don't go around saying, I'm popular. It's actually the masses around them that give them that title, you know. So we're always sort of trying to say, okay, how can we get these girls to use popularity for positive reasons?
Because you talk about five things that kids need to know about friendships, and we'll get to those, but we're talking about one of them, which is having friends is different to being popular. And that's a misconception. They're two very different things, aren't they?
Absolutely. To be popular, you have to be liked by a lot of people. So you have to be a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So you give up your authenticity to a certain degree. Whereas to have friends, you have to be authentic and you have to reveal yourself. So with the kids, I talk about it in terms of, to be popular, you have to put on a mask, but to have friends, you have to take that mask off.
I think too, being popular can be stressful. It's actually, there's a lot of pressure to be in the popular group, and research-wise, again, we know that that's up. Having a few close friendships actually has more positive long-term outcomes than having a popular group of friends.
I don't like the sound of the popular group. But do parents think that their daughter or son being in the popular group is a good thing?
Some do.
Sometimes.
Yes. Some people,
But sometimes it can be a good thing. It depends on how young person has, one, gained their popularity, and two, maintained their popularity. And, you know, as we know too, like, the group as a big whole group presents differently to the one-on-one person who's popular. And we hear this quite often too, is that, you know, I get on really well with her when it's just me and her, or me, her, and maybe one other. But if it's the whole group, that's a little bit more overwhelming. And we know kids change their behaviour based on how many people are around. That's part of being an adolescent. You know, we know they take more risks when they're around other people. So it can actually be different depending on the amount of people. So it's not to say that anyone in the popular group, you know, isn't doing the right thing. It's more about, okay, the status and the likability, and how do we, like, kind of temper those two things together.
And a couple of texts coming in on 0437 922 720. This one says, when I was middle school age, my bully organised three whole classes to make a huge deal if they touched me, and bonus silent treatment. It was so, so hurtful. I could only imagine how horrible that would be. And Jenny says, Nadia and panel, as an ex-teacher and school psychologist, I believe that these children are learning about power, its use and misuse. That's from Jenny. Keep those texts coming in. And if you have a question for our panel, give us a call on 1300 222 720. Norm, my principles of friendship as follows. Long-lasting or bonded friendships is a maturation process. Familiarity breeds contempt. Being socially friendly is not indicative of enduring friendships. And kids, and more so adults, might benefit from the above. Thank you for your insights. Do children understand that friends need to serve a purpose? And what is the purpose?
No, they don't. They aim to have a BFF, best friend forever. That's seen as the pinnacle. And you would have those little girls at the beginning mm-hmm. talking about wanting a best friend. But I think it's really important that they understand that friends serve a purpose, and that one person can't be all things to you. So, and you can't be all things to another person as well. You might need someone to share your vulnerability with. So your person, you have your, you know, your DMs with your deep and meaningfuls, and knows about what's happening at home for you and how you feel about your other friends. There's people that you have fun with, who, you know, let out that playful side with, that you have hobbies with or play sport with. And I think it's also important that kids have someone to think with. Part of the, you know, of our academic and intellectual development is that building of ideas together. Often you'll see little kids walking along together with their heads together, and they're whispering, and what they're actually doing is building ideas together. So they're learning to think together. So having one person is unrealistic, and it's also a little bit dangerous, because when things go wrong with that one person, you're very isolated and it is the end of the world for you. Whereas kids who have lots of different groups of friends seem to be much more resilient, are able to, you know, oh, well, okay, things aren't going well with that person for the moment, so I'll go and hang out with these ones for a while and have a little break.
Nice to have a bit of choice.
Yeah.
A bit of flexibility. Conflict is normal. Conflict among friends is normal, isn't it?
Yeah, this is something that I think we really try to get across to all the young people that we work with, is that relationships, all relationships have conflict, and we really need to normalise that. Sometimes we get, you know, young people that will break up a friendship because there was sort of a couple of, you know, misdemeanours that are really just part of friendship, and that it doesn't mean that it negates all the positive things of that friendship that, you know, preceded that. So we're trying to teach them that, yes, conflict is normal, negative emotions are normal, fights are normal, and we have to learn how to deal with that. We don't give up a whole friendship just because a few things went wrong. Yes, there are some friendships that won't work and we sometimes call them toxic and we might need to walk away from them. But yeah, we want them to know that friendships aren't all beautiful and lovely. They can be, but there's also difficult things. And that's something I think, you know, some young people, they learn it as they go along, but they don't always know it, just kind of innately know that. So that's something that we can teach them.
And do you think parents have an unrealistic expectation that being a kid should be smooth sailing and that you all play and you're all happy and when there is conflict, that's not the norm?
I think the parents that we work with are pretty in tune to knowing that these things are part of growing up. I mean, obviously all parents are different and we bring our own experiences of friendship and school into our parenting. But I do think most of them know that there can be difficulties from time to time. And I think we try to really talk about forgiveness and like working it out. You know, we don't want that silent treatment. We don't want them to just walk away and not have kind of some kind of closure around it or discussion around it. Because often when you fight, work it out, your friendship becomes stronger. And that's something that they need to know. Like that's part of building relationships.
And the fifth one on the list, friendships don't last forever.
No, we talk about friendship divorce. And it happens.
It sounds heartbreaking.
It does. And it is heartbreaking for kids because especially adolescents, often their friendships are like love affairs.
Yeah.
They share everything because they're sort of moving away from their parents a bit and they invest in their friendships enormously. So when they do...
So you're talking sort of year 8, year 9, year 10, that sort of age?
Yes.
Yep, okay.
When emotions are really high at this point as well, just from a brain development perspective too. So everything is just amplified.
Mm. But it's not always dramatic. People drift apart. So, you know, the friends that you have in year 7 are not, probably not going to be your friends in year 12. And that might, you know, just quietly happen through going and, you know, doing different activities and being in different classes and those sorts of things. Friendships don't last forever.
And sometimes I wonder, is that hard for parents to accept as well? Because obviously there's the friendship between parents that survives primary school, and then obviously if the children are going to the same high school, there's that expectation because parents invest in the friendships as well. And I wonder, is it harder for the parents when they see that friendship drift apart?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. I think, you know, you're so much more involved at school when it's primary school. You're around more, you drop them off, you go in for roster, you do all those sorts of things and you build these really lovely friendships with other parents. And sometimes that can be a little bit impacted on when those kids do drift apart. But Linda and I talk to year sevens at the beginning of the year and we talk about these very things and we try to give them like those ideas around what, you know, friendships are really about. And we also talk to them about how much they're going to change over high school. And we ask them to look back about how much they've changed since, like, you know, pre-primary year one. And they all go, oh, yeah, like, you know, so different. Like, you know, and their friendships have changed. And we say, well, that's just going to keep continuing. Like, you are changing. This is like the biggest period of change after sort of 0 to 2 of your life, you know. So you're actually getting to know yourself. You're changing, you're growing, you're maturing, like, interests are different, your values are developing, so it's always going to be different. So you have to be prepared for friendships to change around that as well.
You're listening this morning to Jane Kamignani. She's a psychologist at Santa Maria College, and with her is Linda Stade, an educator who writes about childhood friendship and frenemies. I love that word. Also works at Santa Maria. They're here to take your calls this morning, 1300 222 720. Sharon on the text, 0437 922 720, says, how's this? You can have a piece of chocolate because you're pretty. You can have a piece of chocolate because you're smart. You can have a piece because you're having a bad day. You can't have a piece of chocolate because you're not special. Then the exclusion continues. 18 months on, it still does, but she's stronger than her mother ever was. She's aware of it, but she has moved on. Thanks, Sharon, and that's good to hear that she has moved on, because that's probably a good thing. And Sue says, it's very hard having a twin sister who's socially comfortable and people are forever comparing you. There's always a loser in comparison. So true.
Focus Perth with Nadia Mitsopoulos on ABC Radio Perth.
And in the studio with me this morning is Linda Stade, an educator from Santa Maria College, and Jane Kamignani. She's a psychologist at Santa Maria, and they're here to take your calls this morning. We are navigating the complicated world of childhood friendships, and an interesting text from Tracy. She says, single friendships in adults are also not a good idea. I lost my best friend to cancer 3 years ago and have found that now I have acquaintances but no real close friends. I'm 50 and it's not that easy to find another person to build a really close friendship with. That is an interesting observation, because that's a consequence, isn't it? Keeping yourself with one person.
Yeah, and as Linda said, these things do continue right through the lifespan. It's not just when we're in primary school or high school, and that's why we do try to encourage the girls to, like, you know, always make room in your circle for another one or another one, and do things outside of school as well. Like, if you're in a sports team that doesn't have any kids from your school, that can be a real protective factor, because then when things are hard at school, you know you've got this other group. And the dynamic at school is different, you know, you're with each other all the time, you're moving through pressures together all the time. So when you have these other groups outside of school, that's really important. And I think, yes, that caller, the person who texted, would be similar, like trying to find other interests to remake those friendships, and it's never too late to do that.
Okay, let's look at the response. What are the common mistakes that, firstly, children do in responding to these situations? Or is it more about the mistakes their parents make?
I think it's more about the mistakes their parents make. Often when a child comes home and they, of course, are in tears and they're talking about what happened at school, and sometimes parents immediately get that stab in the heart because, you know, this is the person that you love most in the world and they're hurt and you want to hurt someone. And so you tend to catastrophise it a bit. But in when you do that, you're creating a bit of fear in your child, because it's, you know, oh, it is as big as I thought it was. This is terrible. And that fear can build between a parent and a child. It also shows the child that you don't think that they can cope with this situation. And so that disempowers the child. So I think what you need to do first is just stop and breathe.
Stay calm.
And recognise what you're bringing to the conversation, your fears and your memories of what happened to you at school and all of those things. I think you have to calm all of those feelings to start with, and then listen so that you hear the whole story. You recognise it is one side of the story. I'm not saying that your child's lying or anything like that, but it's their perception of what happened. And listen to understand how they're feeling, not to judge another child or to judge the situation, but to really empathise with them and make contact with them right from the beginning.
So you're listening to understand rather than listening to respond.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, and then you calm the drama, you listen. Child says, this is what's happened, whatever it is, the mean, names, exclusion, whatever it is. What happens then? You let the child deal with it?
Distract them first.
Distract them?
Distract them with normality.
Okay.
Get them into their normal home routines. Jane often says that if everything is normal and regular and loving at home, then the world is conquerable. And I think kids need to get that space between the emotional response and addressing the problem.
So you don't say, off you go to bed, you've had a bad day, this has happened, go and lay down, and that might, as opposed to, right, we'll get your bags, we've got swimming training, off we go.
Absolutely.
And I think too, you spend some time allowing whatever the emotion is. So sometimes, you know, we might say, oh, it's okay, don't worry about it, it'll be fine, like, well, you know, we'll sort it out, that kind of thing. If kids have an emotion, it's never wrong. It doesn't matter what the emotion is. We always have to validate it. We have to acknowledge it. And we have to not shy away from letting them feel it. It's okay to cry. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be hurt. And some, as a parent, a really valuable thing we can do is to label those emotions and validate them and say, yeah, that really hurts. That's a sad thing that's happened. I can see you're really angry, and really allow them to sit in that emotion. I think sometimes we are scared of negative emotions. We want to protect our kids from those negative emotions, and of course we do. Like that's a really normal parent reaction. But when we do that, we're sort of saying, well, no, negative reactions are bad. We don't want to have them because we can't deal with them. They're too big. They're too much. But instead, we sit with them, we let them feel it, and then we work out, okay, how do we then move on from that emotion? That's a really important part of dealing with these conflicts.
And then do you say to the child, I'm not ringing a teacher or a parent? Because do we do that? No, don't ring the parents. Don't ring the parents.
Certainly as they get older, I think, oh, it just depends. Like, generally, there's no hard and fast rules on these things, is there? Like, you know, it depends on the situation. But we would always say sleep on it would be number one.
Don't email, don't phone anybody.
Don't do anything now. Just give it some time because, you know, I think you guys said even leading up to the beginning of this session that some of these things blow over. Mm. You know, they do. And so I've had my kids come and talk to me about things and then I'll ask them a couple of days and they'll be like, what?
Yeah. Oh, over that.
Yeah. So it definitely, yeah. You have to pause, like Linda said, we have to breathe, sleep on it, and then wait for the emotion to subside a little before you start to say, okay, what can we do about it?
And once that's happened, what do you do about it?
Okay. What I do is ask them, what do you want to do about it? Tell me three things you can do about it. And they'll automatically want to say, but he's doing this or she's doing that and she's going to think this, and slow them down and say, yes, but what are you going to do? What would you like to happen? And I get them to give me three scenarios and we talk about, well, which one of them is best?
What would those three scenarios be?
They will give you three.
It might be confront the person.
Yes.
Or go to the teacher.
Ignore it altogether.
Yep.
Go and play with some other friends for a while. They will give you lots of scenarios.
But as a parent, you need to empower the child to decide what course of action. And if that person says, I want you to ring so-and-so's mum or I want you to have a meeting with a teacher.
They very rarely will.
Okay.
Very rarely do they say that. But in fact, they say, please don't ring anyone. Please don't go to school because you're just going to make it worse.
It embarrass me, Mum.
Exactly.
And you're angry. You're angrier than me.
And you're taking their power away.
And I do find, though, like that's become something that they've become a bit more open to. And I really credit the teachers and the deans with that too, because some of them will tell the deans or the heads of year or some of a trusted teacher more so than when I first started working. So there has been some kind of change in that, I think. But, yeah, most of the time they go, oh, no, don't tell anyone. But I still think there are times when they do. The other thing that we probably do with them as well is, like, really we want to, like, turn on that empathy kind of switch.
Mm.
Sometimes when they are making meaning of a friendship thing gone wrong, sometimes we interpret it negatively. We interpret it with, like, there was some kind of intention of malice. And as soon as we do that, the whole situation becomes more negative. So sometimes it's about, okay, well, this is how you're feeling. This is what's happened. Tell me how you think she's feeling. Where do you think she's coming from? And we try to like say, okay, we have different needs. We're all trying to meet different needs. Why do you think maybe this has happened? How do you think she would tell me about it? And then sometimes we say things like, well, if this was your friend, what advice would you give them? So like Linda said, we're trying to empower them to come up with ideas of how they can solve it.
And they'll generally follow through on that. They'll generally decide what course of action they'll take.
Yeah. Particularly girls, I find, are really engaged in that process.
Mm. And that's seeking out deans or teachers or mentors is a really important strategy for them to learn in their resilience, is, you know, learning how to problem solve. It's different for a child to go and speak to a teacher than it is for the parent to come down and speak to the teacher.
Are children reluctant to let mum and dad know if there is a problem, and if a parent senses something is wrong, how do they approach it?
I think it varies. Again, we think it's really important, the connection that you have with your child, all these things, really, that's kind of central to this. So we talk a lot about, as Linda said, we want the home environment to represent this, you know, really safe, unconditionally loving sanctuary for kids to go to, that when everything seems like it's going pear-shaped around them, they can go home and they can have that. So when the connection there is strong, I think kids are talking to their parents about these things. And I have seen, like, over the years, an improvement in that or a change in that, where I think kids are more open with their parents and parents are more in tune with what's going on in their kids' lives, or they're more involved with knowing the other parents, knowing the other kids, having them over, that sort of thing. If they sense something, like the kid's not actually telling them, but they sense something's going wrong, you know, again, that's an opportunity to connect, to ask, to say, hey, you know, I've noticed such and such. Just leaving that open and seeing if they'll start to open up to you. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. But some of that ensuring that connection and that sharing of what's going on in each other's lives is what comes from all our incidental behaviour and relationship building with our kid over the years. And that's where I think parent focus really needs to be, more so than like problem solving or conflict resolution. It's about our everyday connections and making sure that we are really attached with our kids and that they know that we have their back all the time, no matter what.
I don't think parents should be upset if a child won't tell them. Often it's because the child feels like I'm letting mum and dad down, or I don't want to show that, you know, I'm upset. I think it's really important to have parents, which are you know, trustworthy, loving adults outside of the home.
So it could be an auntie or the neighbour or somebody like that?
Absolutely. Older cousins, even older siblings, but people who are, the child has known for a long time and trusts, and that they can talk to. And I think parents need to provide opportunities where your child is with those people and feels safe. If they're only ever talking to mum and dad, that's a lot of pressure on that relationship. So we talk about having five on hand. So for every finger, you should have a person that you can talk to.
And it's okay if a child wants to go outside of mum and dad, and mum and dad shouldn't feel threatened or let down by that, because I'm sure they would say, why are they confiding in Auntie Jane and not me? Mm-hmm. What? Why?
That's understandable.
Yeah. Mm. But that's okay. Yeah.
Well, it is. But I mean, the emotional connection between you and your kids is always going to be, you know, a lot stronger and a lot more, like, you know, emotional, because just by nature. So when you have those extra people that you can just maybe say, you know, say a bit more honestly what's going on. Kids talk all the time about they're scared to tell mum and dad because maybe they'll make a big deal of it, or maybe they won't like that girl anymore and I want to maybe make up with her, and then they think she's a bad person. So they're protecting their friend sometimes, or they're protecting, like, maybe their parents going to be disappointed in them. That's one of their big fears of, you know, adolescence in general, is that their parents will be disappointed, so they don't want to share them. But I do find, like, if there is a good sort of connection there and there's some openness, communication, and parents don't overreact when they tell them things, that they're more likely to share it. But all those extra people in their lives are also important as well.
You both talk quite a bit also about teaching a child boundaries and what, and as they get older, setting those boundaries in the friendship group. So what will I tolerate, what won't I? What is okay for me, what is not? How do you do that, and what are the things they have to keep in mind?
We actually do an activity with our Year 7s where they have a grid where they write, in my friendships, I will, and they list those things, I won't. I will accept, I won't accept, I will be, I won't be. And so we make them think about it, because kids need to think about their friendships and their boundaries before there's any conflict. There's no point, you know, asking a child about their boundaries at a crisis point, because they're too emotional and obviously they're already in the strife already. So it's not going to work then. So you have those conversations early.
And if they have that boundary, does that mean they don't get drawn into the conflict? Because right from the start they say, I'm not going there, because that's...
Ideally.
Ideally, yes.
In theory.
I think it just gets them thinking about it more. And sometimes we, you know, assume that all these skills and these friendship skills kind of just happen, mm-hmm. and that, you know, we're teaching maths and we're teaching literacy, and we're, but, you know, are we explicitly teaching those friendship skills that don't always come easily? That, and as pressures build around them as they go through high school, where we, you know, we throw in social media, like there are some explicit things that we need to teach them, and that's why we do these sort of boundary exercises. And those boundaries might move, they might change, they've got to be flexible, but it gives them like a starting point to think about, okay, well, you know, what does all this mean to me?
And on that point of social media, has that glamorised friendships? Because I love you to the moon and back, and you're my BFFF forever and all of that. And
absolutely.
And as adults, we're guilty of doing that on our Facebook pages, yeah, and things like that.
Instagram,
and
so all of that, yeah.
We're modelling that.
And we put our children in it too.
Yeah. Absolutely. All of this frenemy stuff is exaggeration on social media. It's very easy to exclude somebody using social media by showing lots of pictures of here we are at the sleepover that you are not invited to. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of oversharing on social media, so those boundaries are loosened, and so it's very hard to assume that kids understand boundaries when they're living in this world where boundaries are very blurry.
Mm, that they're friends with people they haven't met.
Mm. Let's have a chat to Carla. Good morning, Carla.
Oh, yes, good morning. I'm listening to you while I'm out in the garden. Well, my daughter, when she was in about year one, had a bit of a friendship conflict where one girl was saying, I only want to be friends with you and not your other friends, so you have to give them up. I guess the advice I gave her, and talking on the point that you're making about understanding friendships, is what we discussed was, even at that age of seven, I said to her, so do you think her behaviour is very nice? Or, you know, is this the kind of person that you'd like to have as a friend who makes you try to do this kind of thing? No, she said. I don't think that that's very nice at all. And I said, well, then you need to decide, I guess, yourself, how you feel about that. And that, I think that worked really well.
Yeah, that's a great response, and, you know, so lovely that she came and talked to you about that and told you about it all, and you were given the opportunity to talk about it. It follows on from that boundary setting, and that's something happening in year one. If you can already start those conversations, they start to recognise, okay, well, who am I comfortable with? Like, who makes me feel good about myself? Mm-hmm. Who do I like to be around? And if we're having those conversations, that they take that through as they are changing and making new friends. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so I think that would have been a great way to handle it. Did it work out?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's good to hear. Setting those boundaries early. Carla, thank you for sharing that. My son actually had a similar situation in year one where one particular boy just wanted to play with him, and my son probably wanted to go off and play with the other kids playing soccer, football, whatever. And it went on for a couple of weeks, and there was threats, if you don't play just with me, then I'll tell on you or whatever. And I asked him in the end how he wanted to deal with it, and he decided he would like to talk to the teacher about it. And that maybe the teacher could help. And it did, and that was fine, and everyone played together, and that problem didn't come again. But again, I thought, well, how do you want to deal with it? What's going to make you comfortable? Because I don't want to be that mum marching into the classroom causing trouble.
And sometimes that is a little bit counterproductive to what the child wants anyway. So, yeah, if we can just have those conversations around, well, what do you reckon? Like, what do you think would be good? And it doesn't mean you have to do that, but it just generates that discussion.
Good morning, Steve.
Yeah, good morning, ladies. I'd just like to say that I had a great relationship with a grade 7 primary school teacher, and it was almost like having a second parent. He taught me to read during lunch break, and then he'd teach cricket and sports after school.
That's lovely.
All that sort of stuff. Yeah, and it stayed with you all your life. It's amazing. Yes. Like that Too Soon with Love movie, you know?
Yeah. Steve, thank you. Those parent-teacher-student relationships are important.
Teachers are awesome. You know, they know your child.
They know everything.
Yeah. And they know in a different way to you, and they can bring a lot of value to your understanding of your child. You know, like if you can have you know, just a little bit of relationship with that teacher can make a difference.
I'll finish on this text. I wish adults had these sort of discussions with me when I was a kid growing up. I still hold on to stuff from my teens because I wasn't shown how to deal with situations and emotions properly and move on. I do, however, think I find it really easy to remember how I was as a kid and therefore understand where my own little boy might be at. I'm a 42-year-old bloke and he's 7. Generally, I think it's all about a sense of control or power, if that's a better word. Control means safety, popularity, identity, and this can cloud considering others' feelings. I think that texter has nailed it.
Absolutely.
As have you two ladies. To Linda Stade and to Jane Kamignani, it has been so good talking to you. Thank you. Great advice.